Welcome to Season 3 of Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Caroline Leland, your producer and host. This season, we've got an incredible lineup of guests for you, from the co-founder of one of the world's first and most successful crowdfunding platforms, to a North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice, to multiple women in the C-suites of major U.S. companies. The theme? Making history. Today, you're about to hear from author and playwright Jim Reston, who graduated in the Morehead Cain class of 1963. Jim is from Washington, D.C., and has been not only an eyewitness to major historical events of the last few decades, but he's actually participated in them, from the Civil Rights Movement, to the Vietnam War, to the Watergate scandal, and more. Jim's father was James Reston Sr., a prominent New York Times journalist and editor, but Jim managed to blaze his own trail in the writing world. Jim has published 18 books, 3 plays, and numerous articles in national magazines. His various works have been translated into many different languages, they've been optioned by Hollywood, and they've been included on international bestseller lists. From 1976 to 1977, Jim advised David Frost for the famous Frost-Nixon interviews, which 57 million people watched from around the world. His narrative of that experience, published in 2007, was the main inspiration for the hit London play Frost-Nixon. In the Hollywood adaptation of the play, which was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, Jim's character is played by the actor Sam Rockwell. Jim has been a fellow at the American Academy in Rome, a fellow at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress, and a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. In the 1980s, Newsweek, PBS, and the BBC nominated Jim to be the first writer on the NASA space shuttle. You'll hear about that experience and other incredible stories in our upcoming conversation. Today, Jim lives with his wife and their adult daughter Hillary in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Our conversation took place during one of Jim's recent visits to Chapel Hill. He shared with me that one of the most memorable elements of his Carolina experience was the civil rights movement taking place at the time.
When I arrived here in 1959, there were still a number of segregated public accommodations, including coffee shops on Franklin Street, and the movie theaters were segregated. And in the 4 years that I was here, that protest against segregated public accommodations took place right under us. So you had a great education, but you were also involved in a social revolution. So, you know, if I could give that same experience to my children, I would be very, very happy.
And you later wrote a documentary on the Greensboro civil rights protests.
Yeah.
Was that connected to your experience?
Well, it was connected in the sense that in the 4 years here, being very active in the desegregation movement, it gave me a deep and abiding interest in the whole civil rights era. And I have tapped that a number of times in my work, including the film that you're talking about, which was a terrible incident in Greensboro where there was a protest in a public housing community in Greensboro, and a caravan of Klansmen came in and got out of their cars and opened fire and killed, I don't know, 2 or 3 people, a dreadful incident. And so it turned out that in the lead car there was a agent provocateur, actually, who was in the pay of the Greensboro Police Department. And he came to me out of nowhere, actually, and wanted his story told. And so that's what that was, 88 seconds in Greensboro.
I read that one of your first jobs was being an assistant to the Secretary of the Interior. Was that your very first job?
It was.
How did you land that position?
Well, I think that's good family connections. Stuart Udall was the youngest member of the John F. Kennedy cabinet. He was the very first cabinet member that JFK chose. And my father knew him. And he was then writing a book which became a kind of classic in conservation lore called The Quiet Crisis. And I was privileged enough to work with him on that, so it was my first research thing. So that became a lifelong friendship. You know, I was really blessed to have started my career with him.
Did you always want to be a writer? Were you always attracted to writing, or is that, how much of that had to do with having a famous journalist as a father? I'm curious about how you came to.
I grew up with a lot of writers in our household, so by osmosis, that was interesting to me. I don't think I thought that I would be a writer until much later. In the case of the work with Stuart, you know, it was a writing experience to begin with the book. But halfway into the 15 months that I spent with him, he got in trouble on a speech. And probably as a whim, he threw it to me, and I wrote the speech for him. And then I became his speech writer for the last 7 or 8 months of that time. So I think that's when it really started to percolate for me, because I went immediately from that job to briefly being a reporter for the Chicago Daily News. Then the 3 years that followed that in the Army, I was very worried that I was falling behind my peers. And in the last year of my service, when I was based in Hawaii, I started to write a novel. So that's when it really got settled in my mind that this is what I wanted to do in life.
Did that novel get published?
That is my first book. It's called To Defend and Destroy. It was published in 1971, and that's how I got hired to teach creative writing here.
What motivated you to enlist? Were you drafted, or was
that's a big, big question. That was the great choice of my generation about what to do in relation to Vietnam. It was clear very quickly that it was not working well, that war. And yet at the same time, the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, was calling upon young men of America to step forward, and there was a draft, of course. So everybody had a selective service obligation. And the question is what you did with that. Did you allow yourself to be drafted? Did you try to get out of it in some way or another, legally or not so legally? I didn't think I was a sincere, conscientious objector, even though I had qualms about what was happening in Vietnam. And I decided that I would go ahead and volunteer. You could make an honorable agreement with the military in those days that if you opted for an additional year, you could pretty well control what happened to you in the military. And I was interested in intelligence work, and so I very carefully negotiated, basically, with the Army recruiter that I would get intelligence training, but then I would get foreign language training. And actually, one of the items that I gave to the Southern Historical Collection just yesterday was a letter that came from the recruiter of the intelligence community guaranteeing me that I would have what I had asked for. So this was a fairly rare way not to avoid service, to accept service, but to control it so that you wouldn't get in, just be a flunky in the front lines.
Were you learning Vietnamese as a language?
Yeah, I was actually assigned to do Japanese.
Japanese.
Yeah.
Are you open to talking about what that experience was like being active duty?
Sure. I was very lucky. I mean, it's totally the luck of the draw where you get sent. In that letter I referred to, it was indicated that I would probably be assigned to have Vietnamese. And, you know, it's clear what would happen if I had Vietnamese. But for just in the shuffle of the great computer, they needed some Japanese language people, and that my number came up on that. As it was, this was 1965 to 1968, which was the height of the escalation of the Vietnam War. And I was in the Army, but stationed in very nice places. I got my intelligence training in Baltimore and my language training in Monterey, California. And then instead of being sent to Japan, which they should have done, they sent me to a headquarters unit in Hawaii for my last year. So it wasn't exactly tough duty.
Which of your projects have you found the most challenging?
There are two projects that were the most challenging. The first was that I did a book about the Jonestown mass suicide. And I was drawn to that material because teaching here at Carolina and being in a kind of a literary crowd, you know, literary references became very important to me. And there is this famous novel called The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, which is about a very charismatic character who goes into the jungles of Africa and goes crazy, but is followed by a great following. When the Jonestown mass suicide happened in November of 1978, it was like the Joseph Conrad novel realized in real life, and I leapt at doing it. I was struggling with a third novel at the time, wasn't working very well, so I went down there immediately. That led to about a four-year obsession with that story to try to understand how could it possibly be that the civil rights lore that I so loved and cherished and felt deeply about was taken by this very charismatic charlatan, Jim Jones, and used to recruit a community of followers who he then takes into the jungles of South America and basically goes crazy in front of them. It's a really profound story, and fascinating as it is horrible. So, you know, I struggled with writing the book, and then I went to National Public Radio, and they did a 90-minute documentary that came out of my research for that, and then I did a play in Providence, Rhode Island, and ultimately wrote the libretto for an opera. So I was just, you know, I just couldn't let it go.
Hmm. You had said there were two projects.
The second most difficult is the little book that I wrote about my handicapped daughter, Hillary, who you know, was perfectly normal up until 18 months, and then some undefined virus invaded her brain and destroyed her language and gave her a seizure condition. And that was, you know, was in the onset of that illness extremely difficult to deal with personally in our family. And ultimately, again for sort of unknown reasons, in the efforts to control her seizure condition, her kidneys failed, and so she was on dialysis for 8 years at the same time she was having seizures. There were a number of writers that I really admired who had written about personal experiences and traumas in their life. And I felt, okay, I'm a writer. I've had this very rare experience. It's been very difficult. I really should address it as a writer. And so I set out to write this little book about Hillary. It wasn't going to work unless two things happened. One, that we had some sort of insight into what happened to her at 18 months. And the other is whether, you know, she would just wither away with the kidney failure. And she ultimately got a kidney transplant, and that really allowed me to finish the book. It had a kind of an ending to it. It wrapped up that story. Anyway, this was extremely personal material. And my wife, who is really a brilliant lawyer and has a kind of brilliant sense of memory, agreed that we would sit down once a week just for a half an hour, and we would try to remember Hillary's story, and then I would take the notes. So That was very difficult. That was a hard book to write.
I can only imagine. There are a couple of specific other projects that I wanted to ask about. I'm interested in your experience working on the Nixon interviews, and then also your connection with outer space. Curious what sparked your interest in space. I know there was the whole space race happening, but would you talk about both of those things, what those were like, being nominated to go to outer space, first of all, and separately your experience working on the Nixon interviews?
Yeah, the whole Nixon side of things was really an outgrowth of this fascinating time in American history. And I started teaching here in 71, and in 73 was when there were these Senate hearings that were presided over by Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina. And I was just riveted by that. I just thought that was irresistible. And I was invited to work with a political guy by the name of Frank Mankiewicz, who wanted to write a book about the Nixon thing. So I took off for the first time teaching and went to Washington. So this was an amazing thing, that a president of the United States was implicated in criminal behavior. And that was the summer in which the revelation of the White House tapes came out. And you know, things started to get really serious about the possibilities of impeachment. So I came back in the fall of 73, taught that fall semester, and taught the spring semester. And then by the end of the spring semester in 74, you know, we were getting into the final act. And it was just irresistible to me. So I went back to Washington and watched those last 6 weeks of the Nixon presidency from June to August of 74. And I have just yesterday morning given the Southern Historical Collection my diary of those 6 weeks, which I hope to publish in the next couple of months. So in 1976, David Frost came through Washington. He had in hand an agreement to do the first and only exclusive interrogation of Richard Nixon in a series of interviews. And he was looking for a Watergate researcher to be his Watergate advisor. And a prominent Washington columnist knew about my work with Frank Mankiewicz and suggested me. And so I got hired to be David's Watergate advisor. It was a really heady experience. Again, I took off teaching. So I did all that research. I wrote an interrogation document for David for the actual Watergate interview. And in the course of that period in Washington, I discovered tapes between Nixon and one of his henchmen that nobody had ever seen before. And so I folded that new material into my interrogation document for David. And that became critical in the actual interviews of surprising Nixon and allowing David Frost to take control of the interview. Because, I mean, Nixon knew the case backwards and forwards and knew what was public, and therefore to be able to surprise him and sort of get him into a trap was very important. The whole thing, and as you probably know from the literature, that eventuated Nixon's acknowledgement of his own criminality and his apology to the American people. Extraordinary.
How did you find that unknown piece of information?
When a critical Watergate trial was held with two of Nixon's top people, H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, there might have been 800 reporters who went to the courtroom and witnessed that, and they went back and they wrote it up. Here I come 2-3 years later, just, you know, getting deeply into the whole material, and I went to the U.S. courthouse and asked for all the documents in that trial, and they brought out box after box, and I went through these things, And out of those boxes dropped the transcript of these interviews that had never been presented in court. They were meant to be exhibits to the in the trial record. And because they weren't precisely on the question of the guilt or innocence of the two men that were on trial, so I was finding them just by doing dogged research. And so that's how that happened.
And then tell me about your involvement with space exploration.
Well, by the time this started in 1984, I think, it was announced that that NASA was going to put a teacher into space first. And after the teacher program, they were put a writer. And I mean, there only had been at that point about 50 or 60 people who actually experienced space. And I thought that was pretty cool and that I should go for it. So I became the Newsweek NPR and BBC candidate for that job. I had, by that time, done a number of articles about astronauts and space travel, and a documentary. I had done a documentary for PBS on space travel. So I had the chops to be a decent candidate for this whole thing. And I really threw myself into it. It involved a number of levels of being interviewed for it, including one that was held here in Chapel Hill, actually. But when they attempted to put the teacher into space, she blew up in the Challenger accident, and that was the end of putting either a teacher or a writer into space. So that was the end of my quest.
If NASA called you up today and said, do you want to go to the moon tomorrow, would you go?
Oh, I will. Oh, in a heartbeat.
One other fun accomplishment that you might be interested to know about Jim is that he retains the record for the most goals scored by a single player in a UNC soccer game. And that was 5 goals in a game against NC State that took place in 1962.
Listen, I have dined out on the Carolina record for the last 40 years.
I mean, when I go out you've held it for so long.
Yeah, well, there's a very good reason that I hold that record, and that is that the game has completely changed to being defensive rather than offensive. In our day, it was all the focus was on scoring goals, and so in the last 30 years, I guess, it's all been about defense. So one goal or no goals get scored routinely. That's why the record stands.
You've been listening to Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks very much to Jim for sharing so openly about his incredible life experiences. So you know, Jim won multiple international awards for his 1983 NPR documentary about Jonestown. And that memoir about his daughter Hillary, which was a book titled Fragile Innocence, that book reached number 8 on the Washington Post bestseller list. Jim anticipates that his next big project will be on the subject of impeachment. As he mentioned during the recorded conversation, he recently donated his diary from the Nixon trials to the Southern Historical Collection. He also sent a copy to the New Yorker, hoping to get some or all of it published. Jim says his firsthand experience with the topic of impeachment feels especially relevant in our current political times. We'd also like to thank Creighton Irons, Morehead Cain Class of 2005, for writing our theme music. Check out more of Creighton's work at creightonirons.com. That's CREIGHTONIRONS.com. Next week, you'll hear from the youngest ever dean of the New York University Stern School of Business, Peter Henry, Morehead Cain Class of 1991. Peter is a leading international economist and recent recipient of UNC's Distinguished Alumni Award. If you like what you've been hearing on Catalyze, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That helps other people find us. Thanks, as always, for listening. We'll be back next week.